From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, coming to you from Cleveland and the Republican National Convention. Oh, what a night last night inside the hall. Mike Pence delivered, but Ted Cruz stole the show with a backhanded slap at Donald Trump from the stage, did not endorse. This morning, he says he won't be a servile puppy dog, but Ted Cruz is not the nominee. Trump is. If he won, what might a Trump presidency actually look like? We're asking this hour On Point, Trump in the White House. Then what? You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did you boo or cheer Ted Cruz last night? And how do you envision a Trump's first 100 days in office, a full 4 years? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was Ted Cruz not endorsing Donald Trump last night. Vote your conscience, he said, and listen to the crowd.
If you love our country and love your children as much as I know that you do, stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
You think that's cheering? That is not cheering. It's this. Oh my gosh. And that's what Ted Cruz was getting on the stage. We're going to look at what a Trump presidency might actually look like in this hour, but first we have to think about last night. I want to do it with Congressman Steve King. He's with me right here in Cleveland next to the convention hall, Republican from Iowa's 4th District, includes Sioux City, early supporter of Ted Cruz, now supports Donald Trump. Congressman King, thank you very much for being here. What did you make of that scene in the hall last night?
Well, Tom, as I sat there, and the Iowa delegation is strong Cruz support,
yep.
And we're not very far from the Texas delegation, and so you know how that is. But that area was strong Cruz supporters, and I looked across that stadium last night, and many were standing throughout Cruz's speech. When it got to that point where you played it,
yep.
The people around me, the Cruz people, they were cheering, and they were saying, that's what we needed to hear, that's what we needed to hear. Vote your conscience up and down the ticket. But
what does that say for the party?
Well, I'd say instead that while that was going on,
yeah.
The Trump supporters were rejecting that. So there were cheers on the one side, there were boos on the other side, and that clashed in the middle of that. And there wasn't a way for that speech to recover because the crowd then wouldn't let him get to that point. His speech was set up to come to a quiet, serious, faithful close, and the noise in the room would not let him do that.
It closed like this.
God bless the United States of America.
Congressman Steve King, where is this party going? I mean, you've got strong Cruz supporters. You were one yourself. Now Trump is there. He came in at the last minute. The spotlights went to him. Cruz could have dimmed on the stage. If Ted Cruz has a big following still, can this party really unite behind Donald Trump in the election campaign? And what about in an actual Trump presidency?
Well, here's what I'd say should be happening right now. Donald Trump should pick up the phone and call Ted Cruz and say, let's have a brunch this morning.
You kidding me?
I'm not kidding.
After what Ted Cruz was saying this morning, I won't be his puppy dog. I won't.
If the call really should have been made before Ted Cruz went on the air this morning.
Yeah.
But that conversation needs to happen, or there will be a division. It'll be very, very hard to close between now and November. And it would impact the speech that Trump will give tonight. Now, how does Trump address this if that doesn't happen? And it's unlikely. It's very unlikely to happen, and knowing both personalities. So if that conversation doesn't take place and there can't be an assurance here that there's going to be a working team effort together.
Yeah.
And I'll say also in defense of Ted Cruz, when he said, vote your conscience up and down the ballot, I think he was operating a little higher plane than a lot of the people there in the floor, because the conscience is, vote the appointments to the Supreme Court, vote a strong national defense, vote an economic recovery plan. All of those things go along with the Trump strategy and Trump campaign. And so there was nothing in the definition of that that should have reached that kind of rejection. But I didn't know when I heard last night that phrase, vote your conscience, had been the kind of the call sign of some of the never Trump people.
We watched, we listened, we did not see an embrace of Donald Trump last night. We saw Ted Cruz looking out for his own political future. We end up wondering what that means for the campaign season and for Trump presidency should he win.
Well, I think that there's. I often introduced Ted Cruz this way, especially when Heidi was there. I would say when I walk into a room, I have to look around sometimes and think how many people in this room are smarter than me. But Ted Cruz never has to do that unless Heidi's walked into the room, and then There's probably somebody in there that can compete with his intellect. So what I say that is, don't count this man out. He's got the right principles. He's on the right cause. The tone of that thing didn't match up with the Trump supporters, and they haven't been very gracious in victory either.
We will not count him out. We just wonder where this is all going. Congressman Steve King of Iowa, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks,
for
Tom.
Today. Last night in the hall, endorse Trump. Endorse Trump. But he did not. What would a Trump presidency look like? It's not going to be Ted Cruz. He is not going to be on the ballot. Donald Trump is. So will Mike Pence be. Last night, Mike Pence was talking about how Donald Trump would treat the military, how he would be with allies.
Donald Trump will rebuild our military and stand with our allies. Donald Trump will confront radical Islamic terrorism at its source and destroy the enemies of our freedom.
Stand by allies. But that is not exactly what Donald Trump said yesterday to the New York Times. David Sanger and Maggie Haberman sat down to talk with him. David Sanger joins us now by phone in Cleveland. David Sanger, thank you very much. Give us the headlines from your big interview with Donald Trump yesterday.
Well, it was an interesting conversation. Took place just before the convention really got revved up in the evening. And a couple of big headlines from it, but I guess the one that's gotten the most attention is where he has said that if a NATO ally was attacked by Russia, we're thinking largely of the smaller Baltic states that had joined NATO after the fall of the Berlin Wall, that whether the United States would join in coming to their aid depended on what their contribution to NATO had been. It's a very different concept of an alliance, very consistent with what he said previously about how allies have to go pick up their share. But he's basically making the American participation in the defense of NATO contingent on whether he's happy with the contributions of others. And that's never really been how the alliance has been defined before.
We're trying to envision a Donald Trump presidency. Should he win in November here? I mean, the whole idea in these treaties in NATO, maybe above all, is that the guarantee is rock solid. I mean, what he's telling you is something quite different. It's conditional. Take us on through your conversation with him. What else that you heard from Donald Trump just yesterday might help us envision a Trump presidency ahead, David?
Well, I think, Tom, what you have to remember is that he views alliances and America's involvement in the world in a very almost mercantilist way, in which he measures the benefits for the United States by trade deficits, by and large. And then says, what are the advantages to us? So, for example, when we got into a discussion of forward deployed troops, and by the
way,
that is
as in Europe, as in Japan, as in a lot of places.
As in Europe, Japan, South Korea.
Yep.
And by the way, the transcript of this whole discussion we have now posted this morning on the Times site. So anybody
very
wants
interesting.
To see the context of it.
He said we might have a unified Korea if we hadn't been in there during the Korean War. But I don't know what kind of unification that would be. That's sort of incredible.
There were several interesting moments along the way, but what he I basically pressed him on the point that the forward deployment is a method of deterrent, by keeping those troops on the Korean Peninsula, by keeping them in Europe, you're creating a higher potential cost for somebody who might act up, whether it's the North Koreans or the Chinese or the Russians or anyone else. And he basically argued, no, we can keep those troops at home and just deploy them if we need to, much less expensively. Well, the argument against that is that if you keep them out abroad, you may not have to get into that conflict at all.
David, you know Washington so well. You know security policy so well. You're talking there with Donald Trump. I mean, are we talking a radical makeover for America's entire relationship with the world? I mean, what he said about NAFTA in here, what did he say to you? It's like, boom, it's gone or something like that.
Yeah, and he said that in a speech once earlier as well. He basically said, I'm going to renegotiate it, and if they don't like the renegotiation, we'll just leave it. He basically said that about the troop presence in Japan and South Korea when Maggie and I did a previous interview with Mr. Trump in late March.
I would pull out of NAFTA in a split second, he told you yesterday. Is this a radical revamp that we're hearing articulated?
Absolutely. I mean, this is not consistent with what you heard from the Republican establishment really going from Eisenhower forward.
Would he stand up for freedom? We've heard that word a lot in the hall this week. In Turkey, they've had a coup, and there's been the crackdown by Erdogan. Is he going to go in and say to Erdogan, ease up here? You want to be part of the European scene? Be more democratic.
That's certainly not the impression that we got from his comments. He was admiring of how President Erdogan had managed to get his footing again and stop the coup and reverse it. He had no criticism of the lockup of thousands of military, the dismissal of the judiciary. He didn't even offer the warning that Secretary Kerry, John Kerry, and President Obama have issued that the Turks have to make sure that they observe the rule of law. And of course, you see this morning that President Erdogan has put Turkey under an emergency decree. Instead, he said, I'm all about the alliance. The number one thing with them is having them fight ISIS. So this is not somebody who I think you can expect is going to stand up and do what George W. Bush did, which was declare in his second inaugural address that the expansion of democracy and liberty will be the guiding light of American foreign policy.
And does this mean, if it were Trump, no more American colossus straddling the world? David, just 20 seconds here.
It could well. I mean, it would be the American colossus that straddles the world if others are willing to go pay for it to do that straddling.
David Sanger with the New York Times. He and Maggie Haberman talked with Donald Trump yesterday. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you again, Tom.
You too. We're going to take care of this country first, Trump told David, before we worry about everyone else in the world. We are talking this hour about what a Donald Trump presidency might actually look like, envisioning how it would be. You can join us. It's time to get real. How do you picture a Trump presidency? How do you picture that first 100 days? What would 4 years mean for the economy, foreign policy, social policy, law and order, war and peace? I'm Tom Ashbrook in Cleveland. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention. Donald Trump will speak tonight. It was pretty wild last night. Tonight's his night, and he is the nominee of the Republican Party. Come November, who knows? He could win. Nate Silver says 38% chance of winning. We'll see. We're talking this hour about what a Donald Trump presidency might actually look like, envisioning how it might be, what it might mean as concretely as possible. And you can join us. Do you picture Trump as being surrounded by strong, wise hands, by his family, acting on his own? It's time to get real. How do you picture a Trump presidency if that becomes the American reality? Remember when he came out and announced his candidacy just slightly over a year ago at Trump Tower in New York? In that speech, he described the jobs he would create, how he would change the game for American workers under a Trump presidency.
They'll be proud, and they'll love it, and they'll make much more money than they would have ever made. And they'll be doing so well, and we're going to be thriving as a country. Thriving. It can happen. I will be the greatest jobs president that God ever created. I tell you that.
NAFTA, out the window as it stands. That's what he told the Times yesterday. In a second, he said. Here he was in June in Pennsylvania.
I'm going to tell our NAFTA partners that I intend to immediately renegotiate the terms of that agreement to get a better deal by a lot, not just a little, by a lot for our workers.
And China, trade with China, forget about it. It's going to be a whole new deal.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
We're going to try and get real about what a Trump presidency might look like. With me in Cleveland to do that, we have three great guests. Megan McArdle is with us, columnist for Bloomberg View. Megan, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa Desjardins is here, political director for the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, it's wonderful to have you in person.
Hi, Tom.
And Heather Haddon is with us, political reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Heather, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
All right. Let's try and just begin to sit back. Maybe we can start with trade. There's a lot to look at here. I was talking to the Times yesterday about NATO commitments, and maybe they're not really commitments. Maybe everything's negotiable here. Megan, when you look at Donald Trump and the economic ideas he's put out, the snippets, the whole hog, as much as you can interpret. Number one, can he just come in and turn over these trade agreements? Can they be tossed out in a second, as he told the Times yesterday?
Well, look, dealing with Trump's policy pronouncements is a little bit like dealing with the Oracle at Delphi. There's not a lot of detail there, and you sort of read in what you want to see. He doesn't seem to have thought this through very clearly. He doesn't have normal economic advisors. He doesn't have a normal advisory team that you would expect, and you would look at those people and say, well, this person has historically been in this direction. That's where I'd expect him to go. He doesn't have any of that. And so you're left to guess. Can he pull out of these trade? I mean, yes. If the United States announces it's pulling out of the World Trade Organization, no one's going to invade to stop us. But it would have massive, catastrophic effects. Similarly, with NAFTA, yes, he could pull out. But if you look at, say, our automaker supply chain, which often stretches into Mexico, if you look at what would happen with the disruption of a whole lot of supply chains, I suspect that if Donald Trump actually decided to do this, what he would hear on day one would be a lot of angry, angry, angry phone calls from people phoning their congressmen to say, you can't do this. Or even worse, okay, fine, you know, I've got half my supply chain in Mexico. I'm picking up and moving the whole factory there now.
Okay, so let's say it's not easy, but Donald Trump works in big signals to the population. He's a populist, and he comes in, and his advisors, you're his advisor, somebody, they say exactly what you've just said. He says, okay, but I have to have action on this. We're trying to get real here. So I promise this. I have to have action on this. What can I do that will be substantive right now on this front? What are his options without blowing everything up, or are there options?
This is part of the problem, is that Donald Trump thinks of himself as a big CEO coming in and being sort of like, you know, Jean-Luc Picard on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Make it
waves
so.
And says, make it so, right?
Yeah.
Is that, in fact, it's more like being a CEO of a corporation that has a 538-member board, all of whom have to ratify
Congress.
Everything that you do. Exactly. So all of those people have to ratify everything that you do. You cannot, it is very difficult to kind of unilaterally go in and do anything, in part because even when you have the power, as we've seen with Republicans in Congress, right, the trade-off is that they have a lot of power to strike back at you by, for example, denying appropriations for things that you want. And overall, he just doesn't have, the presidency does not have the kind of power that either Trump or his followers imagine.
Heather Haddon, Barack Obama came in and ran right into that Republican Congress. Not right in, he had Democrats for a while, but then eventually all Republican Congress. Trump may be facing a divided Congress. He may be facing a fully Republican Congress. Say it's fully Republican, and he's gung-ho on all the things he's promised on the campaign trail. What do you expect in response from the Republican Congress up the Hill?
Well, one thing I'd want to point out is to talk a little bit about his tax plan. Again, you know, he paints these very big ideas, and the ideas have continued to evolve since he announced his candidacy last year. Things have changed, and the tax plan is one of them. So the original tax plan, really broad brush there, where lower income taxpayers weren't supposed to pay anything. Since
tax cut three times the size of the Bush tax cuts of 2001 and three times the size of Bush's,
and what's going to lead to massive amounts of deficits. One of his economic
$9.5 trillion more over a decade, by one estimate.
One of his informal economic advisors right now, Larry Kudlow, was interviewed on Wednesday and has since revised some of the aspects of the tax plan.
What, Larry Kudlow was writing it now? I know he worked for Reagan, but now he's a TV commentator. He's revising the tax plan?
Yeah, well, yes. This was at an event Politico had this week here in Cleveland. And they're now saying, you know, it's more focused on the middle class, that higher threshold earners would be paying more than originally the original tax plan said, but less than still our current tax rates are.
I mean, so I think that's the biggest winner is still the top. I mean, I'm reading here that they would get an average 17.5% increase in after-tax income,
right,
up toward $300,000, compared with 7% for most of the population.
But I think that is an example of how these ideas are really just in play right now. I mean, that's a major evolution of one's tax plan within this week. And his other point was that they are saying now that the House Republicans would agree with 75% of this tax plan. So they are already positing that Speaker Ryan would approve of such a thing. Now, I don't think Ryan has commented on this, but this is where they see an area where they could try to get some compromise with the Republicans, as opposed to trade and those kind of larger...
Blowing up free trade.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to get much compromise there.
Lisa Desjardins, the PBS NewsHour. So he goes to Congress and he says, I want this tax plan. Oh, by the way, it comes with a $9.5 trillion additional deficit. We have heard so much about deficits under the Obama administration from Republicans on Capitol Hill. With Donald Trump, did they turn around and say, okay, let's do it. This is how we restart the economy. We did it with Reagan. We ran up a huge deficit, but we got the economy roaring. Let's do it again with Trump.
That is very difficult to imagine. Now, I will say that Republicans have shown in the last 2 years when it comes to priorities, while they talk a lot about cutting the deficit, in the end, when there's an issue like veterans needing money, when there's a potential government shutdown, they have shown time and time again that the deficit is a lower priority, and they have, in fact, passed a lot of spending that has not been paid for, that hasn't been kind of out there a lot because so much has been going on. So there is some wiggle room for deficit spending among Republicans. They've been doing it. There is not $9 trillion. There's probably not $3 trillion worth of that room. But I think that when we're talking about Donald Trump's tax plan, we might be missing a bigger point here, which is Donald Trump is not running on his ideas. He's putting ideas out there because we are forcing him to. And we are saying you must have policy prescriptions. Hillary Clinton is on his case. So were his Republican opponents. What he is essentially running on, the argument he is making is, look at my skills. I am a great negotiator. So this is where the NATO comments come into play. The truth is, we don't know how he would handle NATO. What he's doing right now is being a tactician and trying to create an environment where he has muscle over the rest of the world. And it's important to note, that's how he operates. We don't know exactly how he would actually execute these ideas or what he's saying, because I don't think he knows. What he does is he sets up a situation that is advantageous to him or his cause. He then, I think, gets in that situation and decides in the moment how he'll operate.
How is that supposed to work in a democracy? You say no ideas, but there are definitely ideas out there.
Yeah.
I will build a wall.
No, that's... Huh? He is putting ideas
out will get out of NAFTA in a split second. I will not do TPP. I will make NATO responses conditional on... Look, Russia's listening to that right now. These things have reality.
But there is something...
They have reality right now as ideas.
All of those ideas have one thing in common, and they are all about Donald Trump trying to gain leverage over another country or some adversary that he sees for him or the United States. So, I mean, that's
the bigger
thing
here. But still, in the end, you do something or you don't. You act or you don't.
That's true.
And he has made promises to the American people on a lot of fronts. I want to look at the wall for just a second, but can we come back for one more minute to trade? What, Megan, can he actually do himself? Does he need Congress to get out of these deals? Or is that an executive power? Is it clear?
You know, Obama and Bush and then Obama have pushed the limits of executive power. But no, in theory, he needs Congress to do this.
In theory or in law?
I mean,
he's a guy who, in theory, Donald Trump would do just about anything. But will the law constrain him if he said NAFTA's over?
Treaties have to be ratified by the Senate. You know, unless we declare war, they also have to. The Senate has to participate in.
What about unratification or pulling the plug? Does that require?
My understanding is that the Senate also needs to ratify pulling out of treaties. But you know, so it's hard to say though, because he, you know, you can really picture him just getting in and saying, Obama said this, I'm putting in the executive order and then sending it through the courts for 2 years. You know,
meanwhile, the deal is off and he's negotiating with Mexico and
Canada. Part of it is that once you announce that you're doing something like that, you sort of start the process, even if you haven't started the process.
Yeah.
Because all of these things mark investments, they mark parallel.
Yes. Even now, there's a process kind of started.
Yeah.
People are watching. The wall. Here's Donald Trump. This is a video posted to his website in February. He described what he would do on his first day as president. He said he would terminate President Obama's executive orders, starting on immigration.
We have a border that's like a piece of Swiss cheese. People are pouring through. That order will be the single first thing I do, and we will work on all of these executive orders, and the bad ones, of which mostly that's what you have, will be terminated immediately my first day in office.
Heather Haddon, Donald Trump steps into the Oval Office and says, I want construction on the wall to begin. Can he do that?
Well, he said in May that in the first 100 days he would have designs for the wall. That's a little different than actually constructing the wall, but he has put that out there fairly recently that he'd at least have designs.
Design? I mean, a design can sit in the closet forever. Everybody who's dreamed about remodeling the kitchen knows that.
Right, exactly.
That's different. But what does he have the power? Does he have to
go
the
executive
get an appropriation?
I'd like to talk about the executive orders, because I think that is an area where he does have actual authority to repeal some of these executive
Obama's.
Orders. Obama's. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I'm also really interested in, I'm looking at Pence a lot, because I feel like, you know, Donald Trump has made these sweeping statements, but Pence, if they are elected, could be the one who's actually administrating the government. I mean, he has said, you know, there were some reports that Donald Trump wanted John Kasich to be his VP because he could actually run the government, where he would be more the, you know, the big ideas, grandeur kind of guy.
Pence, but Donald Trump is not going to take orders from Mike Pence.
Well,
is he?
I don't know.
You think so?
I think we should. I wouldn't assume he wouldn't.
He
I think
says,
we should.
I'll kick out these executive orders, Obama's. Which ones would be in the bullseye for Donald Trump?
But I think some things that they both are definitely agree on, it's justices. I think that is something they could do very quickly, is to make a new appointment to the Supreme Court. Pence has talked
about that forcefully
since
that's a no-brainer.
Since he's announced, and every other time.
But that's
since.
Easy. On immigration, does he reverse policy on day one from Obama executive?
I think he could. Again, looking to Pence, Pence really hasn't talked about the wall. Pence has, you know, talked about immigration being a real issue, but he's also talked about terrorism. He's talked about some broader ideas. You know, I mean, he really hasn't drilled into the wall. So I think there is going to be a dynamic at play if a Trump administration does come to Washington.
Lisa Desjardins, I'm not buying this idea of Mike Pence as the chief operating officer of the Trump administration. I see Mike Pence kind of walled up at the Naval Observatory, vice presidential residence, and pulled out when he needs to make nice with conservatives on Capitol Hill, and maybe Donald Trump Jr. is the COO.
Well, I think what Heather was saying, and I think this possible vision would be of more of a chief of staff kind of vice president, someone who's responsible for organizing, understanding, and maybe working with whoever in the Trump family rises to the top in the White House. We don't necessarily, that could be a son, daughter, or son-in-law. Who has that kind of role. But I think the idea is that Mike Pence would be the man with experience who has to know where the cogs are, how they work, and try and summarize very quickly for his boss what he needs to know and when he needs to
but
know.
But I don't think he's going to drive the agenda. What about the 11 million deportations that he's promised? Can he do that on his own?
He logistically, could he do it? Is a question.
Never mind,
I don't know if he could.
Does he have the legal authority to order,
yes,
say,
absolutely,
starting today,
absolutely,
anybody who doesn't have all their documentation,
no question,
I want
about
them out,
it.
And I want law enforcement to begin the deportation?
Not one question in the world that legal authority exists. I think another issue to look at as far as executive authority, especially with Mike Pence coming on board, are the various ways that gays and lesbians, GLBT, have increased benefits in the federal government. Those are executive orders pertaining to government workers that have come under the Obama administration and could easily be changed in our one.
Heather, do you really see Donald Trump turning that around? That's a place where I just can't see him doing that for Mike Pence. He talks very openly and almost affectionately about the LGBTQ community.
Well, he has in the past. Will he continue? I mean, I think conservatives are really going to be looking to him on abortion, for sure.
Well, there, okay.
And some of these other social issues. And bringing Mike Pence onto the ticket, I think, was a real signal to them that I'm with you, at least in some degree. The other executive order I'd like to bring up is environmental regulations.
Yes.
And I think that's an area, again, that Mike Pence and Donald Trump really agree in terms of...
What would be vulnerable there, Heather?
Well, some of the, you know, clean energy regulations that the Obama administration has pushed through executive order. I thought it was very interesting that on Tuesday night they featured a freshman senator from West Virginia who was talking all about coal and the devastation that the Obama administration rules and some of Hillary Clinton's comments about coal had made for her constituents. So I think that's an area where there could be some fast movement.
Although some of that was EPA, I think, not executive orders per se. But I mean,
what difference does that make? Can you order the EPA to act in a different
way?
Well,
so this is actually, when Trump clinched the nomination, I sort of tweeted a joke that the bureaucracy will interpret a Trump administration as damage and route around it, which is an old, the internet interprets censorship as damage and routes around it. And I think that's really true in a lot of ways.
Until he puts his own people in as chiefs.
Well, but, you know, if you actually talk to people who are political appointees at agencies, what you hear is that they spend a lot of time fighting to get the bureaucracy to do what they want. But Obama's Office of Civil Rights, his EPA, have been very active in who does Trump get in there? Who can he get confirmed? And what sort of person are they? I think we don't know.
Just wait until Donald Trump, reality star of The Apprentice, gets busy with those bureaucrats. You're fired, you're fired, you're fired. You could see a different attitude in Washington if it were a Trump administration. We're talking this hour about what that might look like if it should actually come to pass, with Megan McArdle, columnist for Bloomberg View, Lisa Desjardins with the PBS NewsHour, Heather Haddon of the Wall Street Journal. Listeners, you can join us. It's time to get real. How do you picture a Trump presidency? We'll come right to your calls. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention. Last day, Donald Trump speaks tonight, and we are, in this hour, looking at what a Donald Trump presidency might actually look like, envisioning how it would be, what it might mean as concretely as possible. Last night, on the podium in the big hall right next to us here on Media Row, Donald Trump's son, Eric Trump, talked about his father.
My father has revitalized rundown neighborhoods, shaped skylines across the country, and turned dreams into reality his entire career. It's what he does. It's who he is.
And Donald Trump himself in Cleveland earlier this month painted a picture of life under a Trump presidency, saying that people will be calling their state representatives because Americans will be winning too much.
We're winning with our military. We'll knock the hell out of ISIS. We're winning for our vets. We're winning with health care. We're winning with the border. We're winning with the wall. We're winning on our Second Amendment. Mr. President, sir, you're winning too much. The people of Ohio can't stand so much winning. We're not used to it.
Just can't stand all this winning. You can join us. Let's make it as real as possible. What would you see coming in a Trump administration in executive orders, deal-making, cooperation, confrontation under Donald Trump? Business people, what would you expect from a President Trump? Is it appealing to you? Military men, women, what would you anticipate from a Commander-in-Chief Trump? Skyler in Grove, Oklahoma. Thanks for calling, Skyler. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So,
what do you see coming?
My comment starts with this, and one thing I can say to start out is that I'm a registered independent, and
okay.
I was a former Bernie Sanders supporter.
Okay.
But the one thing that I can say about what I would say that Donald Trump has a lot of negative rhetoric towards him, and it's completely justifiable. But the one thing is that I believe he would be the one that we focus on ourselves more. We spend so much time and so much money supporting everyone else in the world. Our own people are essentially spending their tax dollars overseas when we need money for health care, police department funding. We need money for education. And all of that is getting spent outside of America.
I appreciate your call, Skyler. Lisa Desjardins, Donald Trump telling the New York Times just yesterday, America first again.
Right.
And he said he's on this very front, spending abroad, just military for starters. He said, we're spending a fortune on military in order to lose $800 billion, by which he means America's trade deficit. That doesn't sound very smart to me. This mercantilist view of the world.
Yeah.
How does that work? How does that play out? Since World War II, the idea has been, yeah, we spend big, but what we get in return is a stable world order in which we ultimately prosper. If you turn the dials in the Trump direction, what are the implications?
We don't have any modern context for that kind of world view from the United States. Not since World War II, and you could even argue not since the 19th century, to be honest.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me. I'm hesitant to make any conclusions about that, because we really don't know how that would work, and it could be something that in a first foray into this, whether it's over NATO or NAFTA or TPP or TTIP or whatever, that first moment he does this is when we would learn a lot about both the how it backfires or not, or how the Trump administration reacts. And I think this is what I'm getting at. It's these big ideas of Donald Trump's that are hitting home with people. Here's a caller that is a Bernie Sanders voter, Skyler.
Yeah.
But yet he likes this idea of America first, but we don't have those specifics. You know, and I'm not trying to say that it's good that Donald Trump isn't giving us specifics. I'm just trying to point out this is the Donald Trump approach, and voters need to know that.
American voters are unhappy,
yeah.
But when you pull the plug on the order as it's been, and Donald Trump, one thing he's kind of promising with all his body language is, I'm going to turn the tables over here.
Mm-hmm.
I've had voters say to me, I want someone to come in and throw the furniture around. But when you unplug that order, what are the implications?
Just one thing I want to say real quick. Mm-hmm. Again, the parallel with Sanders is putting America first. Donald Trump has talked a lot about increasing Social Security spending,
yeah.
shoring up Medicare, Medicaid. So he, you know, again, unlike a lot of Republican orthodoxy, certainly Paul Ryan, he's saying, you know, we need to keep that safety net, shore it up, spend more on it.
Where's the money come from?
I don't know.
Nick in Mansfield, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me, Tom. So I have a point and a question. My point is that, you know, based on everything that I've read about Donald Trump, all the interviews that I've read from him before president, and his seemingly willful misunderstanding and ignorance of the way the Constitution, especially the First Amendment, works, I think it's reasonable to assume that his first year in office will be expanding the power of the executive branch and abusing the power of the executive branch. And, you know, that's just based off of what he said about shows of force in Russia, the way that he's responded to the media criticisms, the way that he said that protesters were violating his First Amendment rights, which is just, it's like, oh, sweetie, that's not the way the First Amendment works.
Mm.
My question is, I've been listening to a lot of Trump supporters. I've just been trying to get the lay of the land and understanding why they are for Trump. And I haven't actually heard any points for Donald Trump. I've heard a lot of questions about the way the process is. I've heard a lot of...
Nick, what do you mean? I mean, we have Trump supporters calling us all the time, and they make... They say, look, we want jobs. He says he's going to bring us jobs. They say, look, he's going to, you know, get us out of this box in which we're not happy. He's going to take care of working people.
There's been no specific points on how he's going to bring this up. Most of the vast majority of the arguments that I've heard from Trump supporters are ethos-based. They're dissatisfied with the way the economy is working, and Trump is saying, and he's a very good salesperson, that he's going to fix it, but there's been no actual points for it.
Let us look at that, Nick. I appreciate your call, but let me look at that, if I may. He has said on infrastructure, Megan, he said he's promised a $1 trillion rebuilding program, patch up roads and airports and bridges and water systems and the power grid. I mean, that was what was promised by Obama. There was money put toward it. It somehow didn't really happen. Hillary Clinton talks about the same thing. Is that possible? That could put a lot of people to work in a hurry.
Infrastructure is the ginseng of political policy arguments. It is a kind of broad-spectrum snake oil. It fixes every problem you have and some that you didn't know you had.
Well, what's wrong with it? A lot of serious people said we should have done that when interest rates were so low, and they're still pretty low.
Well, infrastructure is great. There are definitely infrastructure things we need to do, but it's got a weird coalition behind it. So, for example, a lot of liberals love, the American Society of Civil Engineers has this report saying we're $2.6 trillion worth of infrastructure spending we need to do. Problem. First of all, the American Society of Civil Engineers, which is the folks who build, they're not exactly a disinterested party.
Hire us.
Second of all, most of the infrastructure they're calling for is highways, which is really, really, really unpopular with the liberal coalition that likes to talk about infrastructure.
Yeah.
Everyone's kind of imagining we're going to have like green, whatever. It's highways. There's bridges, tunnels, a little bit of rail,
no problem with highways.
No, right. But it's really expensive. And as Barack Obama found out, there is no such thing as a shovel-ready project.
But the cost of doing those things is on the other side of that equation, jobs. And he's promising jobs.
Yes, but they are jobs for a relatively small number of people. I mean, construction is not, you know, back in the 30s when FDR was doing this, you got guys out with shovels who are literally digging your roadbed. Now it's one guy with a bulldozer is doing the work that 100 men with shovels would have done. So, yes, you create jobs, but not that many, and not enough to offset both the costs and the environmentalist opposition you're going to get on those highways.
Wayne in Binghamton, New York. Wayne, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love
Hi.
The show. I've been a Trump supporter from day one, and I'll tell you why. Number one, the first thing I liked about him was he was not a politician. I personally have lost faith in all politicians. I think that they're inherently out for themselves. First, then the people second, where Trump, I believe, didn't have to deal with that. Number two, I like the statement that Trump made early on when he said, I don't have all the answers, but I will find people who could advise me and will help me solve the problems. He's never claimed to be a know-it-all.
You don't think Trump is out for himself? I mean, he didn't get to be a billionaire by giving it away.
No. I think he sincerely loves the country. I really believe it, that he wants to help the United States. I love the country, too, but the reality is, what is the United States number one in? Well, we're number one in military spending. We're number one in world deficit. We're not number one in education. We're not number one in life longevity. We're not. I mean, the reality is we're not the greatest country in every way that we think we are.
I hear you.
And I believe that Trump wants us to improve these things. I definitely support his ideas that, you know, why should we dishing out money to other countries when we get very little in return? All we get
We got it. I appreciate your call. And you're right. When you make the list of things that we're number one in, it's not the prettiest list anymore. And sure, Donald Trump is speaking to that. Military spending, very, very large American military spending. Donald Trump is commander-in-chief. Let's spend just a minute thinking about that. This was last September. He was talking with Hugh Hewitt. Promised he would find the next General Patton or Douglas MacArthur, that the day after he took office, he would know more about America's enemies than you will ever know, he said.
I will be so good at the military, your head will spin.
Okay, simple as that. But what's he going to order the military to do? He says he doesn't want another Iraq war, but he says he would go in and bomb ISIS. He said he would even bomb family members of ISIS. And there was this interesting moment, former CIA Director Michael Hayden, this was in February with Bill Maher, HBO, and Maher asked what would happen if Trump followed through on his pledge to kill family members of terrorists, of ISIS.
If he were to order that once in government, the American Armed Forces would refuse to act.
What? Oh, well, that's quite a statement, sir.
I thought the whole thing was you have to follow
orders.
You cannot. You're not committed. You're not required. In fact, you're required not to follow an unlawful order. That would be in violation of all the international laws of armed conflict.
Lisa Desjardins, think about military with us for a second. He said, I will do this. He said, I want to bring back waterboarding, it works. Right. He said, and here's Hayden, you know, Michael Hayden, he's not the director of CIA anymore. Easy for him to say whatever he wants to Bill Maher. But would the military be ready to just do whatever Donald Trump ordered?
I think of all the theoretical groups that are nervous about Donald Trump in Washington. Some in the military and foreign policy sphere are probably the most nervous. While Donald Trump touts his unpredictability as an asset, to them, it makes them incredibly nervous, and they are worried about precisely this situation where he gives a command that they think is A, unlawful, or incredibly dangerous and for this nation, and could lead to a larger war. And in that moment, how is that handled and by whom? The CIA has consistently in the past few years said waterboarding is torture and we will no longer do it. If he orders it, then how does the CIA do it? Does he replace the CIA director with someone who follows that order? This is a very serious and kind of keeping people up nights now issue.
And it gets creepy in a hurry when your vice president has a rather different political tinge. Maybe people in Congress and the military not happy about what the president might be doing, and there's Mike Pence, real orthodox conservative, sort of buttoned up guy. Ooh, it's creepy. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
But guys, I've listened to the entire show, and I'm very disappointed in you, Tom, and your guests.
Let's hear it.
Because you all are speaking about this man like he's a normal human being. He's the
nominee. He is the Republican nominee. He's a player. He's in the system now, Carl.
Right. But you all are having hypotheticals like he's a normal person. I watched an interview last night with the guy who was the ghostwriter for Art of the Deal. And he said he spent 18 months with Donald Trump. And he is, in his words, a sociopath. And if you look up the definition of sociopath, Donald Trump is the breathing, walking, talking embodiment of that. This is a very dangerous human being. And Tom, you know, I've called you for years, and I've talked to you for numerous presidential.
Happy to have you, Carl, but he could be president. He's going to be on the ballot.
I've never been this hyperbolic about a presidential candidate. Romney was acceptable. McCain was acceptable. This guy is a very, very dangerous individual. And for us to normalize him, like what he says is normal, and that he would take the normal policy steps by following the Constitution, is a disservice to the public abroad. This man is
Carl, I've got it. Our time is short. I think we got it very clearly. Okay, people who don't like Donald Trump are going to say, do not normalize him. And I get it. But he is now the Republican Party's candidate for the presidency of the United States. I mean, November is not far away. He could be elected. Do we have to look at him in a different way, Megan?
Look, I think he is. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not equipped to diagnose personality problems that Donald Trump has. What I can say is that I think it is absolutely right that he is not a normal political candidate. He is not bound by a lot of the conventions that political candidates have. You know, when you look at things like politicians all exaggerate what their plans are going to do. They downplay the costs. Yeah. They upplay the benefits. But it's always there's always like some ratio that is a reality, a ratio to reality of these claims. And Donald Trump just blows through that and just says it's all going to be great. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. None of his numbers add up. He doesn't. There's no kind of context for this is a budget. I'm going to how one thing affects the other. It's all, you know, and that's actually it's great, right? Everyone wants to go to heaven, but no one wants to die. So he's promised everyone everything because he is not in any way constrained. And the things like these interviews with the New York Times, things like the fact that he doesn't have a normal campaign staff, he doesn't have a normal fundraising operation, he doesn't have a normal anything. So yes, he isn't a normal candidate. He's very different. But you know, saying he's a sociopath doesn't actually give us a lot more information than talking about what he has done and
what he might
do.
Which again is why I think we need to look towards some of the more traditional politicians that he has started to surround himself. Beyond just Pence, Chris Christie, head of his transition team, who, you know, has some of Donald Trump's, you know, big statement, kind of pugnacious tendencies, but also, you know, has talked about foreign policy in a little bit more rational sense.
Do you think he would be normalized by those around him?
I don't know. I won't go that far.
Okay. But. Okay. Lisa?
You know, I definitely respect Heather so much, but I don't know. I think we need to keep our eyes focused on Trump. I think he tends more to change those around him than to be changed by them. And I think what the caller in Nashville was getting at, you're a longtime fan, great listener, was the media. And I think clearly the media was a little late to really seriously scrutinize this candidate because I think many in the media didn't realize how far he would go.
Well, we've been talking about him for a long time. We're still talking about him today. We're talking about what he might do because it could be him. And the election is not that far away now. We'll hear from Donald Trump tonight in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention. Carl, no sweet solace for you there, but this is going to be a candidate on the ballot. We're dealing with it right here. Lisa Desjardins with PBS NewsHour, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Heather Haddon with The Wall Street Journal, thank you very much, Heather. And Megan McArdle at Bloomberg View, thanks so much, Megan.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention. This is On Point.